stopped working on one, she could finish it on five.
Welcome back, everybody. Slight change in plans, and for the better, I am certain already. Lily is a former student who saw what we were doing in the class this time around, and because she has a lot of knowledge in the medium of film, and because she knows that I do not, because she's generous and doesn't want this to be a complete failure, she volunteered to spend a little bit of time giving us a sense of some of the fundamentals of this medium and theories about how it works, because we are going to be applying something not from the field of film to the question of how does this all work, to have some sense of how people who study this on its own merits as its own medium, how they talk about it. Thought that would be very valuable. So thank you so much for coming and being willing to do this. You can have as much time as you like, and then after you're done, we'll do a break, and then when we come back, we will talk about that exceedingly dense transcript that you all had to read for today, and I have some nuggets to pull out of it with you. So without further ado, and I caught a terrible cold in Amsterdam. My wife is a registered nurse, and I was not feverish this morning, and so she says I'm not contagious. But I'm going to try not to cough on you, nevertheless, and no hugging like we normally do here.
Cool. So I'm glad that I can talk to you guys today, because I was a film major here at U of M for 2 or 3 years, and even more so than that, my dad runs a film society in Kalamazoo. So I've legitimately grown up around film and analyzing and critically looking at film like my entire life, and it sucks. Like, I'm just going to tell you now that once you start studying this stuff, you can't. I've had to like create a switch where you flip it on and off, because being able to sit and enjoy a movie is very hard when you're looking at all these little pieces of information that are like built together to this one glossy image. But I actually wanted to ask you guys, like, how many of you have like tackled film analysis or criticism? Okay, cool. So a few of you. Feel free to jump in wherever I am at, because I've tried to condense so much information in like 60 minutes, and it might not actually work. So feel free to ask questions along the way as well, because this is super informal. But basically where I wanted to start is way back in 1895 when film was first created. And the apparatus was made by Thomas Edison, and the Lumiere brothers started to just kind of put a camera somewhere and just let it film. And so, like, this is all they had back then. And so this was what people were looking at. And then about 121 years later, in 2016, we have these really rich, vivid images that have a lot of motion, that have a lot of color, a lot of sound. So I kind of want to just stress that, like, when we look at digital information architecture and interfaces as we do UX or whatever you're doing. That's only been around for about 30, 40 years, so we have a huge toolbox here to work with. And Wes Anderson in particular, he came on the scene in 1996 with Bottle Rocket, and then you saw Rushmore, which came around in 1998. So he's using a lot of techniques and patterns that people have established over time, and he is a huge fanatic of film. So he's watched a bunch of stuff, and he uses a lot of things that, you know, back with the Lumiere brothers, what the original filmmakers were trying to figure out. And this is just, like, so gorgeous, and I love Wes Anderson, so I'm super excited to talk about him. I want to kind of... I hate Christopher Alexander, I'm just going to put that up front, but I kind of want to tackle his concept of wholeness, and refresh me if I'm wrong, it's just kind of that you step into a place, you have this overwhelming feeling, like a part of you that wasn't there is now there, like you are just complete with the world. Is that it?
Sure.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Okay, my interpretation of it. I think that this could apply to film as well. Because when you go into a theater, you're just kind of completely enraptured in this world that's built for you. It's a very passive medium, it's not active. You kind of sit there and you see this world that has made for you to a T, And sometimes, like the 2.5 hours that it is, it goes by in like 5 or 10 minutes, and you are overcome with emotion and feeling, and these characters that aren't real are very real to you. So I'd like to, you can argue with me if you want, but I think that film has that sort of ability to make us whole and feel feelings, and like it shows us what's human. And I don't know if any of you have had films that have done that to you, but like for me, The Lives of Others, that was made in 2010, just a gorgeous film, and every time I watch it, like it's just, I am absolutely overwhelmed, so. I wanted to kind of, this is brainstorming mostly on my part, and I think that if we're looking at this glossy image, when we go into a theater and then walk out 2.5 hours later, we can break it down into 3 major categories, which would be visuals, so everything that you see composed like in the frame, structure, which is basically editing, like how images work together, and then audio. But this is a super glossy overview as well, because like these are everything that's going on, and this is just my own brainstorm, so I'm probably missing like 100 things. And it's very overwhelming, and I'll share this with you guys later so you don't, you know, freak out. But I want to kind of look at this filmmaker's toolbox and go over some of the major things that Wes Anderson uses, because I think that might be useful for when you tackle your own film analysis and try to apply information architecture to it. The first word that I want to introduce to you is mise-en-scène, and this is basically everything that Wes Anderson does. It is a French term that was borrowed from theater, and basically it's everything within frame that you can see. So the movement of actors, the things, the color, the movement of the camera, that's all applicable. The only thing that mise-en-scène does not cover is audio. So anything within the character's experience audio-wise or the soundtrack is not included. Cool. Basically, I didn't know how granular I should get in this Incredibles image. I've had it on my computer for about 7 years, and I'm not even kidding. I'm so excited that I can finally use it. But I kind of wanted to show you guys pretty much. So the camera is the eye that the filmmaker is using in order to construct these images. And the way that he frames a shot is usually very important. So like an extreme close-up, that usually is a nuance to very little pieces of information. So if you're looking at someone's face and their eye twitches, you might not be able to get that from something that's really far away. And so that's a really important piece of information that, you know, the film is trying to cover. There's a bunch of these words that I'll probably be using at some point. So the close-up, the medium shot, and the full shot. And I have another slide to kind of illustrate what all those mean that doesn't have the Mr. Incredible on it. But you can also move the camera in specific ways to create meaning and symbolism. So if you have, I don't even know what this is, to be fair, like this weird, strange creature. But if you have a camera that's very low and a person seems like bigger, that might mean that they have control, that they have power. It really depends on, you know, what the filmmaker's trying to use. Eye level tends to be a very common sort of thing so that you can see the person. Having a high angle might mean that the person that you're looking down on, like whereas the low angle would have someone really big, the high angle would have someone really small. So like I think of the Matilda scene of all things. I don't know if you've seen the film Matilda, but when she's being talked down from her parents, she's very tiny looking up. And that's an imbalance of power. The canted angle, which is just a funny depiction of it, it's usually when the camera is tilted to the side, so you'll appear like sideways. And using it, it's also called a Dutch angle. But using it often means something's very wrong with the screen, and it really kind of sets you sideways, which is the intention of it. Bird's eye, that's a pretty common thing in photography and in film, where you can kind of get a grasp of the entirety of it. And I know that in Rushmore, which you guys should have seen, he used bird's eye like quite a few times. I have no idea what worm's eye means, so I'm just going to ignore it. And this is kind of an illustration to you beyond, you know, the Incredibles, that you might be able to see what each of these really means. The extreme long shot usually has a lot of information. There's often called establishing shots. So, like, if we are here in North Quad, we saw a picture of the outside, and then all of a sudden it cuts to me talking, you can infer that I'm in the building. So that's usually pretty important, or to kind of show, like, where the characters are in space. And this, too, like, I love close-ups, and Wes Anderson uses, like, so many close-ups in his cinema to really kind of break down emotions, to break down, like, the importance of objects and little facial feature stuff. So while these angles and the way that it's framed are very important, the movement of the camera is also super essential. I didn't find examples of these because GIFs are really hard to find, actually, of camera techniques. But I can show you guys. So a pan, which is what Wes Anderson uses a lot, is when the camera moves from side to side. He does this thing called a whip pan because it goes super fast and it's a pretty frantic motion. Tilt is when you go up or down. So if you want to reveal, like, someone with a medium shot, you don't know exactly what's on their bottom, right? It could be hooves, it could be, like, pantsless, whatever, and you can tilt down and reveal all that information. Dollying is moving through space. So if the camera's here, it can move forward. The actors can move too if they want to make it look like they're floating, but it's just kind of moving vertically. And tracking, which is what Wes Anderson uses a lot, is basically when you're moving side to side horizontally. I have a bunch of clips to show you guys of both Wes Anderson and not Wes Anderson, so I can show you, like, you can kind of visualize these in a few minutes. The ability to use focus helps depict the space in cinema. So shallow focus, you usually have one thing that's really, really clear, and then everything fades away. And in this example, this is actually from a film called Rome, Open City. It's beautifully done. And this priest he's facing the execution firing squad. And he is about to die. And all these boys from his parish kind of come in and start singing a tune. And while you think that the firing squad would be the most important, because, I mean, he is about to die, it's just, like, overwrought with emotion at hearing this tune, at these boys that he helped, that it just fades away in the background. And that shallow focus is really, really influential and powerful, because everything could have been clear, but he made the decision not to do so. So this is just one, like, little example of how shallow focus can really be powerful if used in the right way. Deep focus, what happened there? This is utilizing depth of field, where everything is clear within a shot. And everything is kind of important. And I have an example from Citizen Kane, which is, like, I hate this movie, like, with a passion of a thousand suns. I've seen it 12 times, and I'm not exaggerating, because each one of my classes makes us watch Citizen Kane. And it goes down as one of the number one movies of all time. It's, on a technical level, amazing. The storyline sucks. But this is just, like, a really quick explanation of how he utilized depth of field, because I'm really bad at explaining some of these things.
We are so excited to be making a commercial with you.
So excited.
You just want to tell people all the ways they can listen to Apple Music, even offline, like on a plane, in a car.
Stop. Here's your commercial. I'm driving through the desert. I see a small boy. I walk over to him. He says, I say, fancy the music. And I hand him an iPhone.
Why don't you give him water?
Okay, try this next one. I'm in the jungle with Alicia Keys.
Alright. That's gonna happen a lot, guys. I'm sorry.
With respect to the said newspaper, the said
what he's saying is important. This is a will, basically, that he's reading to Cain, and he's very close to the frame. When he lowers it down, he reveals another person there, which you otherwise wouldn't have noticed.
Publishing properties of any kind whatsoever, and agrees to abandon all claim.
Which means we're bust.
He's going further in frame. So now when you see how big this space is, he's very small, which in this instance he's...
What are you doing?
What?
Whoa. Like, it's on the screen, but it's not on the screen.
Which you wouldn't think because it's in use.
Did maybe the,
See what I mean?
I see light. Light.
Naturally.
What the?
It was overwhelming.
I know, right?
What?
Yes, hard. This film is all visual for the most part.
Okay, I'm going to reboot the system. Not that one, this
one. I know, right? Watch the commercial and not what we need to see.
Aw, dude.
I can get back to it.
It made that one reboot now, too. If anybody would like to take a bio break, this would be an excellent time to do so. I predict many moments of rebootery is in the offing.
Yeah? Oh, do you have a question? Yeah, sure. What up?
So it's a technique that is used pretty much at the director's discretion. It usually utilizes movement. You're not like doing a harsh cut for something else. So you're keeping the same frame, just changing it up. So what Wes Anderson does in particular, especially like with his constructed spaces, where everything's set on a train, which is super enclosed, super tight, and he uses hands in order to make sure that space isn't as stifled as it could be. So I think, I'm not even sure when, because he uses the whip pan, but sometimes panning is just used to track movement through a space as well. So if I'm walking over here, instead of letting me go out of the frame, it follows me. And I think that's just to make sure that it, because cuts, and I'll go into editing a little bit later, cuts can be very jarring if they're not used correctly. And if you want to immerse someone in like a realistic, I guess, world, you want to make sure your cuts are on action, or if you can just remove the cut in particular, like with panning, people use them. So does that help a little bit?
I don't know, does anyone else have any questions? Because I'm gonna whirlwind my way through this, so.
We're almost through the progress bar of display cooling, please wait.
Awesome.
So you just heated it up too much?
You just brought too much signal to the otherwise noisy world of, please. Please?
Well, that's interesting why it went there.
I don't know. But it says projector warming. And we didn't have to reboot. Isn't that funny? Yeah, it was cooling, and now it's warming. A whole thermo.
But you know what? This is like totally a throwback to me in film school here, because technology would never work. Especially watching clips. So like my old film professors would spend 30 or 40 minutes getting it up.
Kind of ironic for a technology school. Yeah. Technology doesn't work. Okay.
Cool.
Please resume. That took far shorter than I thought.
Please don't. Thank God. No commercial.
Please to abandon all claim.
Which means we're bust.
All right.
Out of cash.
So he's at a crash. She's
going further in frame, and suddenly he's very small. And that's only because he's using his focus.
You're a fool to call anything else.
And this character is known for being really great and kind of big and nice. So this is, he's very diminished.
Charles Foster Kane, as long as
I
live, I'll continue to maintain over your newspapers a large measure of control.
So now he's getting control over these newspapers, and suddenly he's getting bigger in frame again. And where these guys are sitting down, he's towering over them. And so that's very, very smart filmmaking in order to kind of create meaning where otherwise, you know, when you're watching it kind of in a glossy way, you might not pick that up. But that's essentially what that scene is meant to do.
It doesn't like to go forward.
Yeah. So this is another, so we have shallow focus, we have deep focus, and we have rack focus. And this is a beautiful gift from the movie Young Victoria. So you have a crisp image, and then suddenly it goes from shallow focus to, in focus to out of focus again. This is a very extreme rack focus. Usually it's when someone is talking, there's information behind them, and it goes from their face being really clear to becoming blurry, and then the information behind them is revealed. So that's a way that filmmakers can kind of hide things from you, and the reveal then makes it a little bit more impactful or unique. And this is just gorgeous. This is a strange rack focus. Color. I'm not going to go too in-depth with color, because I think that you guys, especially as designers, may have gone over color theory. And color, do you guys want me to go over color in-depth, or...?
There's a group that's going to have to go deep into it.
All right.
Then you can get the highlights, for sure.
No. Color's been around for a pretty long time. Most people kind of go back to The Wizard of Oz, or Gone with the Wind as being the first films, I think... 30-something to have color, but actually color's been around since the 20s. It was used in Georges Méliès' fantastical kind of images, and he would actually paint frame by frame color, and it was very expensive and took so many hours. But back then, color was used often either for symbolism or to depict fantasy, and it's definitely evolved since then. But what I like about Wes Anderson is that he kind of touches back on that fantastical realm in the way that he uses color. Because all of his spaces are usually super saturated and rich and almost create a dreamlike quality. And he'll use color to really create symbolism. Just even thinking of Rushmore, because I watched it for the first time last night at 11 p.m. So I can't go too in-depth with it, because I'd have to watch it probably four or five more times. But looking just in the way that Jason Schwartzman is dressed in his coloration in comparison to everything else, everyone's wearing button-up, very white shirts, and he's all of a sudden in this blue kind of straight-laced jacket, and he really stands out within every frame. That's important because he's the outsider in that film. And these are just, I Googled this, so some color schemes that he uses. But it's also really important to use to create tone, because Wes Anderson is often very nostalgic, so he uses a lot of yellows and browns and greens, and that's really important in specific movies like Moonrise Kingdom and kind of Fantastic Mr. Fox, that harks back on a Roald Dahl movie or something like that. So, lighting is tricky. Lighting, I'm actually not very good at. And Wes Anderson, thankfully, doesn't really have a lot of really dynamic lighting structures. He has really flat surfaces, and he uses color mostly to make up for lighting. But it's really important, especially in film noir. This is a gift from The Third Man. And using silhouettes and shadows and encasing people in darkness and in lightness can really give credence to the character and the world that you're building. So this is a reveal of a character that has been very shrouded in mystery, And he's still shrouded in mystery. You don't know who he is, but he's bigger than life because of this like lighting structure that they did. And it can be super powerful. And a lot of lighting techniques are taken back to painting, like Rembrandt, stuff like that. So if you know lighting and photography, you'll tend to know lighting in film. This is my favorite, mostly because when I was at U of M, I was an editor. I've edited probably like 4 or 5 films, and basically this is what builds like the structure and the backbone of a film. Because you could shoot everything, you could line up your frames, compose your shots, and give all that footage to me, and you say, I want it in sequence. And I can make probably 7 different films from what you're trying to give me. And the only way to do that is to play around and see what matches with what. So I think that while it's important to look at space in the way that what's in the frame, this really kind of further defines what the space is. This is what I'm going to do. There's this big thing called continuity editing, and it's probably what you guys are most familiar with in the narrative. Everything is very realistic. You're not very jarred when you're watching something. And things make sense in your brain when these images connect. So this is an example that I line match. So I don't remember what movie this is from, by the way. But she's looking up, and all of a sudden you see what she's looking at. So that's like a natural jump. And then you go back to her. Her eyes are still following the painting, and the painting is looking back at her. So it makes sense together that she's looking this way, someone's looking that way, and it's not like looking the other way around, if that makes sense. So her eyeline matches what she's looking at, and that makes you kind of sink into a more believable reality within a film. And this is a really big part. This is just like a confusing diagram, and I actually have a video that explains it way better than I can. But when you are on a set, there is a very specific rule you need to follow called the 180-degree rule. And the camera can be anywhere along this line. It cannot be over here when people are talking together. And that kind of matters with the eyeline match. And this will better illustrate, because I think that I got confused with this for years. And then this made a lot of sense. And this is looking at... the movie Vertigo.
Important cinematic tool. Let's begin with the establishing shot, or master shot. Here, we clearly see the spatial relationship between Scotty and Midge. Now, let's draw an imaginary line between them. This line is known as the 180-degree line. The line, or the axis of action. This line is very important to the 180-degree rule. It determines where the camera will be placed to preserve screen direction. Remember, the camera will be placed on this side of the line only. Otherwise, the cinematic space will become illegible. On this side of the line, there are 180 degrees of space that can be safely occupied by the camera without disorienting the viewer. Hence the title, the 180-degree rule. When cutting between two characters who are interacting, this is what adherence to the 180-degree rule looks like. However, if the camera jumps the line, the character's position in the cinematic space becomes incoherent, like this.
So that wouldn't make any sense, and I'm not going to subject you to like all the film lectures I've ever been in. Interesting. So that is really important to adhere to. People do jump the 180-degree line. And that usually is done in a very purposeful way, that if maybe someone's in a dream sequence and that jumps the line, it kind of lets you realize that you are not watching a real thing. The medium of film becomes very apparent that you're watching this apparatus-like construction in comparison. I want to show you guys a scene with really masterful editing, just to kind of show you how... these cuts go together and how pacing and rhythm is super important. Because the more cuts you have, depending on the
more action you have, I guess, it can be really useful, or depending on how slow or fast you want to go, is very influential on, you know, what the idea that you're trying to promote. So this is like one of my favorite films by Howard Hawks called His Girl Friday. And this is the like original newspaper movie. So everyone's going to be talking really fast, but watch how the action amps up over like 2 minutes.
Excuse me, madam, are you referring to me?
No, you did.
What about
these
parents? Kidnapping,
huh? Also, look at how claustrophobic this space is. There's so many people in this one room.
I was standing right here, and that girl jumped out the window.
Call
me,
get over here right away. Now, look here, madam, be honest. If you were out joyriding, plastered, or got into some scrape, why don't you admit it instead of accusing innocent people?
And that was a very long time.
How dare you talk back to me? They're just a little crazy, mother, and I can tell you something more.
Also, like how the audio and the editing works.
Don't take any chances.
You
shoot right through the bed.
Anybody who's got a gun here, oh dear.
Go on, you gray-haired old
creature. That's a pan shot. And then it completely closes two different spaces that existed.
Want to see a scoop? Now everybody, all by our name right in the center. All right, Carl, Frank, what if you get on each end of the bed?
I'm coming up.
We got you covered, Williams.
Just a minute. Don't try to move. Any time now. I'll count three. One, let's go in an emergency. Two, any second now. Three, open.
I got you, Williams.
Go ahead, shoot me.
Come on, Williams.
Well, we must have you go to the bathroom with a couple of quarters and pass the desk.
Come on, on your feet.
All the audio matches on cut, too, especially as everyone starts talking at once. And everyone is structured within the space and blocked in a very particular way. So, this is just, like, super masterful. Howard Hawks was kind of like the king of continuity editing. That he manages to cut so often and have so many people within a space, but you still retain, like, you know where they are, you know how this room is structured, and everything makes sense, even though, like, they're talking 100, like, seconds a minute. It's terrible. Like, the entire movie's like this, so you have to watch it probably, like, 50 times, but definitely worth watching. So... that showed some rhythm. This is actually the importance of cutting things together. So match cutting is two separate shots that are matched by action, and it's also very symbolic. So this is from a movie called Un Chien Andalou, which is by Salvador Dali and Luis Buñuel. And they don't have to infer that they're cutting her eyeball in order for you to know that they're cutting her eyeball in half. Because you have this image of the action of slicing, but then you have that beautiful little like sliver of cloud going across the moon, and you know what happened without seeing it. And this is really great. I think that Wes Anderson uses this a lot as well, where you don't really see the action, but you infer the action, even though it's not explicitly shown. So this is pretty important. And jump cutting is also super important. That's the idea that two sequential shots are taken from different angles. So if I'm here, the camera's looking right at me, then it might cut to someone where you're still looking at me, but the camera's right here. And it's kind of a weird thing to do. Like, it's very jarring and very specifically done. The only other way you can jump cut too is temporal jump cutting. So it's basically just removing like seconds in like one long frame. And this is actually a Wes, I'm not going to reveal too much from the Royal Tenenbaums, but this is a scene that shows you how this is done.
You want to play some word games and do some experiments on me or anything?
No.
So this is one long shot of Luke Wilson, but all of a sudden you're missing frames in between. So it makes the scene go by a lot quicker than it could, while also making it interesting. Because what is he doing and what is he going to do, you don't know. Yeah, I'm not going to reveal too much because I know that some of you are watching this. But that, I've noticed that Wes Anderson will use this in very crucial moments, kind of like this scene in Royal Tenenbaums. Okay, I love montage. It's a really cool thing, but everyone kind of thinks of the Rocky sequence, where, you know, you're running, you have a training video thing, and then all of a sudden it's done. And while that is montage, it's not what montage originally meant. It usually is a sequence that can be sequestered within a film. So if you look at it individually from everything else, it should hold up. But montage in early days was actually a Soviet-Russian theory, where basically the crux or the backbone of film is juxtaposing images that are related to each other, but also very extreme. So extreme that it shuts off the projector again, because this would happen to me. Do I have to shut it down again?
Let's try toggling it to a different input. That didn't help last time, but...
Yeah, should I put my computer up? Would that be useful?
Maybe, because then we can toggle between it dying and...
Okay. Yeah, so I can continue, though, because I don't have a clip to show you yet.
It's crazy, though, because the PC didn't go to sleep.
I know.
Maybe the bulb in the projector is dying, and it gets hot to a certain point and dies. That was about the same interval of time. No, it was shorter that time. I think we're going to have to shut it down and restart it. Okay.
Well, these are like unscheduled breaks, if you guys have any
so
questions.
So once again, if duty calls, it only took about 5 minutes last time, so maybe three.
I can continue actually with montage a little bit, because I already have an example. So it was a Soviet-Russian theory that was made specifically, like, developed in the 20s, and it's the backbone of cinema. And basically, you can put these two images together that are very extreme to create symbolism and to agitate the viewer. And of course, like, the Russians wanted to agitate everyone. They had some really gnarly sequences. So that's kind of where it started, and it's like the basis of finding meaning in cinema, and that's why they use so many extremes. And I want to show, once this like miraculously pops up, the Lev-Gluishov effect. I don't know if you guys, I think you might have tackled it in 588 in the psychology course, but I'm not sure. Because this was stemmed from Russian filmmaking, but basically he realized that he couldn't, Lev-Gluishov realized he didn't really want to make cinema, but he wanted to study it. And so he has one image of this man staring at the camera, looking, just kind of looking, and he imposes it with a photo of hot soup. And then it goes back to the man. And so you infer there that the soup is too hot. The man can't eat it. Then when you're on the same shot of the man, he goes to a frozen, like, wasteland. And you're like, wow, this man is cold. Or the soup is cold. I can't remember what it referred. And then you see the same shot of the man again. And then the third shot is a picture of a risque-looking woman.
So you get to infer there that he's feeling very lustful. And it's the same image. It doesn't matter. Like, it's just one shot of this guy looking at the camera, but you infer so many different meanings because it's spliced with a different image. And that's pretty much what the Russians wanted to explore back then. There was I debated showing you the sequence of the battleship Potemkin, which is also another movie that I hate, that I've watched way too many times. But this has a really important sequence in film history and cinema history, where there's this big battle, and you see everyone just, like, running everywhere, and a woman gets shot, and she's, like, holding her bloody, like, stomach. And you don't know where she is within space, but it's a very powerful image comparison to, like, the absolute chaos that's happening. And then you see these guards marching down these steps. And a little boy gets shot, and this mother, you know, is carrying him up these steps, trying to besiege these guards. And I think that the most famous sequence is this baby in a pram, like a stroller, the mother gets shot, and the pram starts rolling down these stairs, and he's just bouncing everywhere. It's an insane sequence, but that's kind of what the original meaning of montage meant. How montage is used now, it's more like a compression of time and space, where, like, that Rocky sequence, you know, that technically is montage, but not in the way that it was originally meant. And this is actually, because it's 15 seconds, so why not? This is what I'm talking about with the Lev Kuleshov effect. Soup. I forgot about the dead child. Well... you can infer sadness from that, but it's the same dude doing the same thing, so it doesn't matter. But that's.
I'm gonna quote that.
Thank you. And actually, I know you guys have seen Rushmore, but let's just watch this really quick because this is the way Wes Anderson uses montage.
What's his name again? Max Fisher. Sharp little guy. He's one of the worst students we've got.
And this is the juxtaposition of Jesus. So this is a juxtaposition to what you just heard. He's the worst student they have, but all of a sudden you have this sequence of just, like, random things that he is a part of. So that doesn't match up with what was just heard. So you don't know what's really happening in any of these things. Like, it's not shown to a death, but you know that he's just involved with everything and so good. Okay. You guys have seen it, you get the gist. Audio. So that was a, you know, really quick wrap-up of editing, and I'll go into it a little bit more later, but audio is not my forte, and I got lazy with these slides. So I started to kind of just give you a big summary of audio. So it's basically used to enhance the viewing experience. In the beginning of cinema, people were really worried about sound, especially when the talkies were created in the late 20s, early 30s, because especially with visuals and the structure of editing, that was the crux of cinema at that time. And people thought, like, seeing Charlie Chaplin all of a sudden speak is going to be weird, and it's not something that, you know, should be done. But it actually ended up just enhancing the image, at least in my perspective. And that can be done through dialogue, soundtrack, cues within the world that the characters can hear, and then other cues, I guess, for the viewer. So I think that you guys are using the word diegesis in a different way than I'm going to use it here. Okay. And basically, just what I just said, diegetic sound is happening within the world in the space that the characters are interacting with. And non-diegetic pretty much means, like, soundtrack and stuff that they can't hear, or voiceover narration, which Wes uses a lot.
I think that's already used.
Is that using it?
Yeah.
Good. Okay.
I had a question about that.
Yeah.
What about, how would you classify something that maybe is a little bit of both? Like, for for example, like the Flash, like the same music that's being played is also soundtrack to the movie. Is it like a
Yeah, that's a clever thing that people will do, especially like if that's what the character is hearing, then you can infer that that really means something not only to the character but the space as well. That's just a directorial choice, and I think that that might actually just kind of further solidify how important that song is to the space and defining the space. Well, I was actually thinking of, in Rushmore, when Bill Murray is, well, not Bill Murray, but Jason Schwartzman goes to Bill Murray's wife and tells her that he's cheating on her. Like, they're on that rooftop sequence. Do you remember that? And just as he's about to, because they're in this, like, cityscape, and just as he's about to tell her, all of a sudden you hear this blaring siren. And technically that is existing within the space of that shot, but it's so loud, and they're on a roof, that that's almost unrealistic, the extremity of that siren. So they're hearing it, but at the same time, it's like being used in a very symbolic way, because he's kind of crossing a line, and I guess if you want to interpret it as a siren instead of an ambulance. So when his voice gets drowned out by that siren, you can infer what he said, and also just the fact that he is like a little shit ruining everything. It's true. I actually really enjoyed Rushmore, but what a 15-year-old. It plays on emotion, because without, I mean, so up until the 30s, you didn't really have sound. You had like an organ or something playing separately to what was on screen, and they tried to enhance it that way. But when you ramp up music or you slow it down, those mean different things. I'll actually play a clip from Psycho after this, because that just shows how music and how audio can really like make you feel things like to a degree that's just like so intense. But just know overall, it does play on emotion of the viewer. It can make a scene believable and real, no matter the genre. Flesh that scene. Basically, like, so you can construct so many different worlds in a film. It can be fantastical. It can be suited, like, based on reality. But if it doesn't make sense in that space that the filmmaker is trying to create, then it might be very jarring. So if you're in the woods and you're like going for a hike, and all of a sudden you hear, I don't know, like, intense rain, and it's sunny out. That might be a very jarring thing to do, because this is not the expectation versus the reality, you know? So that could kind of take somebody out of the realness of that space. Or it could just, like, I guess when you're watching films and watching Wes Anderson, just keep your ear open, because there's a lot of little noises that actually mean a lot that you just kind of, I guess you don't think about when you're just watching it face value. Like the scene in Rushmore where he finds that aquatic book and all of a sudden you hear sea life in the background. That's pretty important. And even the fact when he's like talking with the teacher and he drops something in water, like when she's around, all of a sudden you hear a lot of water noises, like always, that becomes a major theme. So, and that also, like, that doesn't make the scene believable. Wes Anderson is weird, mainly because, like, he creates these spaces that are very sincere and very real, but they also are rooted in absurdity. So it's not real, but it's real to you in that moment. So playing, like, that water noise or, like, hearing the ocean just makes sense in that space. Just keep that in mind with what you're watching. Can be synchronized or desynchronized. And desynchronized sound usually like alerts the user to the medium that's being, you know, viewed versus synchronized. And like dubbing, for example, if your words don't match your mouth, it is super frustrating. And some people do that on purpose to make the user frustrated. But, you know, it depends on how real you want to be. Yeah, and just soundtracks too, the words and lyrics can give double meanings, and relate to visual material. And I was talking to my dad, and he actually runs a film class at Osher in Kalamazoo. And I was asking him how he describes audio since he teaches it. And he said that it could be as much of a character as the people on screen. So especially with the soundtrack being so important in the way that Wes Anderson in particular uses soundtracks, everything is very meticulously picked out. So like the soundtrack for Rushmore, for example, uses a lot of British invasion music. So you have like Cat Stevens, you have, I don't know if he used the Kinks.
Yes, he did, okay.
He actually was going to base his entire soundtrack off the Kinks, which is really interesting, but he decided not to in that. And Rolling Stones, and you know, you have that kind of upbeat sound, but there's a lot of anger behind it, and a lot of young people being like angry with the world. So that was all chosen very particularly. And he also uses a lot of acoustics, if you haven't realized yet. And I think that's to create a lighter tone within the film, because everything that he does is very whimsical and very nostalgic. But then it's like cut with this rock song, and it works because that's what the character is. He's a 15-year-old, you know, in discovering, I guess, his... He's a shitty 15-year-old, but he's also 15, so you have nostalgia back for that time. And it's very light in the way that he presents all these like really kind of deep and dark things. But then matched with, you know, the anger of the soundtrack of the music. So, okay, I actually wanted to show this because this goes down as like the one of the most critical sequences in the world, both with editing and audio. And how many of you have seen Psycho? I mean, it's a pretty yes, it's a pretty well known movie. But the way they use 50 edits and 77 different camera angles, all within 3 minutes. And so you have the person being attacked, and you can actually hear the knife cutting with...
I shoot you. Sorry.
This looks terrible, by the way. But the emotion, it makes you, like, really, like, I hate the sequence. I love the sequence, but I hate it at the same time. Because you're in the space that's supposedly safe, right? Like, you're in the shower, and you're feeling very voyeuristic at this moment, too. Because you're not supposed to be in the shower with this woman. So, like, I get really, like, claustrophobic in this moment. And that would be a jump cut. Close up, eyeline match. Also, the shower sound is very believable to this world. The violin matches with the action and the cut. You don't actually see anything happening, but you know exactly what's going on within the space. And she's gone. That would be a tilt. And that's going to be dollying out a little bit. And she did. I'm not going to show the entirety of it, but that kind of illustrates how sound can be really crucial to a moment, especially soundscapes are often very powerful in horror films or when you're trying to create fear or maybe a thriller movie. So in this instance, like, and the
composer who made this, like, it was his idea, I think, to do the screechy violin noises, and it just works so beautifully. I think Alfred Hitchcock
did
a wonderful.
Does she hear those, or do only we hear those?
We only hear those, so that would be a non-diegetic sound. But the thing is that this sound that only we can hear, that infers her terror. So she might not be hearing these things, but those reflect the emotions that she's feeling. She's, you know, she's going to die, and we know she's going to die. And because we can hear these noises, which, like, I don't know about you guys, but it kind of, like, makes me grip in my seat a little bit. Like, I start reacting in the way that she's reacting, so.
How do you know she's not hearing these
sounds? Huh?
That is a good point. It's debatable, but from what you hear and what you see in the rest of the movie, they haven't established something like that. Because a lot of people will, if they're hearing the same noises, they'll usually break frame or give some sort of indication that they hear it. So if they're listening to, I'm like thinking of Stranger Things actually right now, I'm listening to Do I Stay or Do I Go by The Clash. If he turns off the radio or if he's interacting with the radio, you can infer that, you know, he's listening to this music that's being played. This, I don't really see her reacting to the violin as much as she's reacting to a knife. And because you haven't had her interact with any other sounds, like in this manner, like throughout the film, you can pretty much come to the conclusion that that's not part of her soundscape. Does that make sense? Okay. I don't know if I'm going to show this. Unless you guys want to watch it, I thought this was actually a really good use of, I can just describe it, I guess. So in the payback scene where he's, you know, doing all these terrible things to Bill Murray, which is so funny, because he's 15 years old, and what a 15-year-old thing to do, even though he does it in pretty ingenious ways that most 15-year-olds do not. They're playing a song about forgiveness and, like, I forgive you. And while you hear that sound, like this, I forget what song it is at this moment.
It's the quick one while she's away.
Huh?
It's the who? It's a quick one while she's away.
Yes. Playing that song, like the lyrics are completely contradictory to what you're watching in the way that he is completely ruining this man's life when I think the song is... I don't remember the lyrics entirely. That's probably why I put the clip down, because I watched this last night. Yeah, how about? Until the projector, like...
Not working.
Oh, right.
That sounds pretty good right now, even though this is an allergy.
It's not addictive.
Well, you're just like, looking how she's colored and never
yet,
too.
Yeah, I'm addicted to alcohol.
Really?
Really?
I love the bees. I'm not sure. I'm gonna get right to the... Yeah. I love Jason Taylor, so I'm like, he's such a good guy. This is also, fun fact, his first role ever. He ended up being a Wes Anderson staple after this. Ah. There's that tilt. So just like the anger behind it, saying you are forgiven when he obviously is not forgiven, and even just relating to the content that they're fighting over the same woman, even, you know, one's 15, one's like 50, you know, this is a really important song to include here. Because they could have chosen something completely irrelevant, or they could have gone with acoustics, but
that was a choice that someone made to say, no, in order to make this seem powerful and funny, we're going to juxtapose it with the music that's involved. I hate film theory, but you know, we're gonna do it. So I think that this is actually really applicable for you guys. It's this concept called auteur theory. It was made in the 1950s in France, where the French New Wave was going on. And basically these guys just like ate cinema up like candy. And one of them, Truffaut, who he made 400 Blows, he was like 24 and a little shit at the time. And basically he decided, he was like, all right, there are people that are good filmmakers. They have authorship over the thing that they're making. It's only their vision that matters because I see an aspect of them in each of their films. So we're going to create a very subjective category of these like young white men to decide, you know, these are good filmmakers that should go down in history, and this is why. And so like auteurs at their time was like Antonioni. You had Alfred Hitchcock, you have like throughout time like Scorsese, stuff like that, people who are very noticeable in their techniques. But this theory also really, the reason I don't like it is because it ignores everyone else within a crew. So the people who make the soundtrack, who often like make pretty common soundtracks like throughout different films, they're ignored. You have the cinematographer, completely ignored. You have the script, the people who write the scripts, completely ignored. So in that instance, auteur theory has been pretty debated, but you still have these concepts of modern auteurs, and Wes Anderson falls into this category because you see similarities between all of his films. He uses the same themes, and he also, you see like a part of him within it. So like Rushmore, for example, was set at the school that he went to when he was younger. And he also, like, the way that, what's the character's name, Max? Is that it? Okay. The way that Max makes, plays and directs them, Wes Anderson would do that too. And Owen Wilson, who helped write the movie and is like one of his collaborators, actually got kicked out of private school. So this is rooted pretty much in their lives. So it has that sincere note to it. But each of his films touch on something that's important to Wes, and you can recognize that. So this is where I think this will be useful for you guys for Wes Anderson when you're doing your film analyses. You have the toolbox, and when you have these established tools, people will use them in different ways. And Wes Anderson in particular takes certain concepts and he repeats them over and over and over again. And this is just my own brainstorm, but you see symmetry in like all of his shot compositions as shown like to the right, like it's undeniable. He loves, like, I think that you can just probably pick hundreds of his frames and he'll have someone directly in the middle, which is crazy. He uses the same crew and the same actors, same cinematographer, like the people that he works well with. He often will work with again and again. They'll create similar content. So all of his worlds are pretty different, but he's similar characters. And he even said in an interview that he feels that all of his characters could meet each other in one world and they could coexist. So the way that they deliver lines, usually pretty quick and witty, but also have some sort of distance related to them and the way that they act or are perceived to act. And the worlds, like especially when you think of the bright colors, like look at how saturated all those frames are. There's definitely similarities, even though like one is a stop motion animation, that these worlds could all coexist. We touched upon it, the frantic action, motion, panning, and tracking he's very famous for, because he bases a lot of his movies within action and meticulously composes things and actors and just stuff in space. So that's an important thing to recognize when you're watching. Everything is very whimsical, and this is a common theme between like all of his
all of his movies, and that can be converted to color and characters. Cause, like, when you think about it, there's like this sense of boyhood, especially when you look at Rushmore, where he's so much older, but he's still a boy, and then you have Bill Murray, who is like an old man, but still a boy. So all these characters are very whimsical and just kind of contradict each other sometimes. He uses narration a lot, especially with letter writing. I noticed that because I've seen like three or four of his films, but seeing Rushmore for the first time, I realized like how important letter writing is to Wes Anderson. And you don't have to like read the entire letter because you have someone like doing it for you, and that kind of works with typography. Because he's very into calligraphy and very into imposing typography either within the space. So like the first scene of Rushmore, like Rushmore is actually like a sign that people can see. Versus like when he is doing like a voiceover narration where you have like something digitally altered or printed on the screen with typography. And I touched on this a little bit earlier, but all his films are like extremely absurd in a way that it's just very subtle, but it's not real. Like the characters will do things, like if you have a 15-year-old who like is building a full-size aquarium with $10 million, that would never happen. It would never happen. But you believe it because this is the type of character that he's fleshed out for you, and the way that he interacts with others and the way that he interacts with the space that Wes Anderson created, you believe it, but still you recognize like, holy shit, how did this kid get $10 million? Like Bill Murray, how, they're so similar, but why would you have this 50-year-old become friends with a 15-year-old? So, some things to keep in mind. I don't want to tackle this one. It's not even finished. Let's not. So I listened to like your first lecture, Dan. He imposed this question of what makes film good, which is a super loaded question. But I thought it might be interesting to talk with you guys, like what you think is a good film, because the way an audience perceives a good film and the way a filmmaker perceives a good film can be two very different things. So, does anyone want to take a stab about what is a good film to you? And why do you like it, and why would you watch it over and over again, or why would you recommend it?
I'll start with something that you said, which is that you lose a sense of time. The pleasure, just for me, in and of itself, being free from chronology is one of the pleasures of film that it does super well. And somebody last week said something really fascinating, which is in film, time works like space does in architecture.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that, if a film is good, it is mastering the elapsing of real time as well as the perception of time.
Cool.
It's a mix between familiar things that seem very homey to you and completely novel things that sort of like take you out of your complacency and like, you know, make you think or just in some way like make you interact with it, that they challenge you. But at the same time, it can't be too crazy because then you're just like, what is this? So it has to be, there also have to be aspects of it that you somehow can resonate with. So
yep.
that makes a good point.
Definitely. Yep.
When it creates a world that's consistent with itself, it plays by the same rules throughout.
Yep. So when it, especially if it sets up weird rules in the beginning, then yeah, that makes sense when it's carried out. I'll argue with some of these because, like, look at superhero movies, for example, which are really the Hollywood churnout right now. People can go in and they find it very entertaining. They, you know, sit through 2 hours. They love it. But it's pretty clear, especially with critics, that it's not a good film. Like, something like, I don't know, Guardians of the Galaxy, I hated that one, for example. A lot of people thought that it was really, like, poorly done, that it was technically not very sound, it was, the narrative pacing was incorrect, and I think probably 100 other things that were wrong with it. Yeah.
I think
what you're bringing up actually is the same thing that makes me take issue with Christopher Alexander, and this feeling that all of these things are objective, that design is objective, or that aesthetics doesn't exist. And I take issue with that, especially for a film like, let's say, Guardians of the Galaxy, you know, like something that might seem flawed or incorrect to someone who has any sort of training might seem fascinating and wonderful to a 9-year-old. And there's a difference, sure, in that perspective, but I don't think that discredits that 9-year-old's perspective on that film.
Yeah.
So I already think that there's a problem with this question from my perspective, that there is no objective, and I'm kind of sticking out to the rest of it.
That's good, because I'm going to let you now, like, know now that film theory, like, the majority of it is bullshit, and I hate it. Like, I'd sit through my theory classes being like, oh my god, why are we here? Like, I get this, what you're trying to promote, but also, you know, film is very subjective. So if I find the lives of others a beautiful emotional sequence, you know, of images, someone else might think it's the worst thing ever. And that's actually kind of like how I feel about Citizen Kane. But the thing is, where at least critics and people who have created film theory, is that there is a way to look at film, like an art to it. And so while I might hate Citizen Kane, it's boring. It's so boring. I also look at it, and I know why it's good. I see why, how it was made in the time that it was made. Orson Welles was 24 years old. I am 24 years old. What am I doing? He created this magnum opus that created new techniques into storytelling. He, like, did all this crazy stuff. And I look at it in that way, and I watch it 20 times. And I'm like, all right, this is good. And I can conclude that it's good. Which, it's a crazy thing. Like, I think that it's weird and upside down, but critics themselves, like, it was the number one film ever made. Right now, I think it's Vertigo by Alfred Hitchcock, which is also pretty boring.
But I think that there's something of, like, we've almost been brainwashed into saying, okay, if everyone says it, then I'll say it too. And there's this groupthink aspect of what you just said that I take serious issue with, you know, from perspective as someone who's, like, really sticking to this whole thing that aesthetics exists and and also from, like, a social perspective, that if we allow this in the arts, how does it play out in the rest of our lives? And I feel like there's a deeper conversation here about how what we're talking about in the safe space of the classroom plays out in the rest of our lives. But it seems very dangerous.
I think a lot of it also, at least with film, it's the way that criticism has been written and, I guess, consumed over the years, because now it's completely different than how it was. You would have one critic per paper who is supposedly an expertise in, you know, this realm, because they've watched probably a million movies. I've watched a million movies. I've watched a lot. And they will base what has been made, what they know to be good, and they will decide based on those factors if this either, like, pushes the medium or if it adheres within the medium, whatever. So nowadays, you have criticisms from everyone because of the internet. Critics don't matter as much anymore because you have people who aren't as learned within, you know, the space that are giving their opinions, which can be a good thing, but it also could be a bad thing too, depending on what they've seen and what they know. And the fact that you can feel things and maybe, like, not study film, like, I wish I could watch movies nowadays without, like, going into the mode that I'm in, being the person that I am. I almost wonder if it's a better way to experience it, you know? Because I don't get to experience what you guys experience, and it sucks. I rambled a little bit. Sorry about that, guys. Sorry.
So I just want to say, I think that it comes down to defining what good means. Mm-hmm. I don't know, previous semesters, I think class, we've looked at a lot, but what does good mean? And I think there is more than one way for film to be good. So something like Guardians of the Galaxy, I think for movies like those, I would never watch that movie alone, but I would absolutely go with friends to see it. Because it's the sort of thing that you and the audience together are experiencing this action, and you're, like, feeling each other's emotions as it happens. Versus, like, a good movie is something I want to watch by myself when it's dark outside in my bed. Like, and I want to be absorbed into it. I don't want to have to socialize with other people while I'm being in this movie world.
That tackle is also another huge aspect that I wasn't going to tackle, but it is important. It's the way that you situate yourself in space to watch movies. So, like, on Friday, I saw The Room. It's the worst movie ever, and Tommy Wiseau was there, which was beautiful. Just FYI, if you ever see him, like, see him. He's incoherent. And it's a terrible movie. It's done so poorly. The acting's bad. The narration doesn't make sense. But everyone was so rowdy and so, like, loving it and yelling at the screen that it became active. It was an active experience that it made this film not great, but bearable and, like, and entertaining. And I lost time, you know, watching the crowd more than I was watching the movie. Or if you're watching something with a bunch of friends in a dark room of your home, like, people can talk over each other, you know, it's a different experience than if you're sitting in a dark room, like, with a bunch of strangers by yourself. And film, like, theaters right now are having a really hard time trying to figure out how to stay relevant, because you can access film now everywhere, like, on your phone, on your computer, doesn't matter where you are, so it also kind of, like, detracts from the experience a little bit. But that's, like, my personal feelings. Go ahead.
Different categories. If you take Christopher Nolan's Prestige, like, he begins saying that every magic act has three parts to it, and then he comes to it and then he ends it over there. So it's a feeling of completeness which you get after you watch the film. And the same pattern you can be also when you're watching Kung Fu Panda 2, same, when they talk of inner peace in the beginning, then in the middle when he actually comes to talk with it, and right towards the end, where he knows.
And I think that, you know, that's a really good point, that you can approach this from so many different ways. So if you're looking specifically for narration and the way that the film, you know, it, like, composes of ideas and pushing you, that's very different from me watching on a technical level, which I'm a formalist, and a lot of what I just went over reflects more like how I interpret film by looking at, like, the little pieces of the puzzle that all work together. So, like, I can't explain how many times I'll watch something, I'll see something that's not dubbed correctly, and it'll take me out of the experience, like, immediately. Where someone that might not have, like, done this over and over and over again might still be, you know, really involved. So I think it depends on, like, there's just so many pieces that go into one film, like, the audio. Like, if you're really, you're an audiophile, then you're going to be listening to the sound more. So the fact that you have critical theories, like, they're pretentious. But, you know, each person is looking at it for a specific reason. I think that the holistic of what makes a film good is very subjective. But depending on the expertise that you have, or lack thereof, you're going to be looking for different things. That makes...
I'm sorry. No, you first.
Oh, but you saying what you just said there would be a lot more sensible coming out of the mouths of people who claim to be, well, I am now in a position to deliver a verdict on this film, or, you know, game, whatever it is they're reviewing, you see people frothing at the mouth, you know, I need some objectivity in your reviews? Because that's why
reviews
are going to be subjective. So the very idea that we can, you know, essentialize, you know, the way you're experiencing it and coming at it from a performance perspective versus coming at it from a comics history's perspective, and you know, mash all that together into a, you know, yay, good status seems like the source of a lot of unnecessary, you know, infer, because you're not going to get a yes or no answer on whatever good, and if you do, it's by its nature subjective, not objective.
I think that what helps you decide what makes a film good is trying to, like, at least with me, I've looked at a lot of different theories. I've looked at the way people review, and I look at how I absorb film, so I've kind of just, like, immersed myself into this world of cinema and listen to how people are talking in all angles, and I pick the approach that, you know, makes most sense to me and what I feel is the most powerful. But again, you know, that's a subjective thing. I think it's just making sure that you're aware of all the bits and pieces. And I guess that's why I wanted to talk to you guys about film, because it's really easy to forget how many pieces of information, you know, make up something like the seventh seal, which is what this background information is. Yeah.
So aside from breaking the technical rules, is there a normative theory for what makes film good out there? Has anyone posited an ordinary way that is beyond cultural idiosyncrasism or personal preference?
I'm gonna say no. Again, there's like 121 years going into this, and so many voices arguing against each other. I actually lost my film theory book because I was gonna go through and like reread stuff, and then.
Well, it doesn't surprise me that there isn't, and it makes me think that there's some value in what we're doing here, in that no one in film would ever say that you could bring a yardstick to it and say that it's good, irrespective of context. And so that's what we're going to be playing with.
Yeah. It's just such a loaded question. I can point you guys to some film theory if you're really interested in it, because they also kind of look at it as a medium of, like, replication and stuff like that. So, like, is it fantasy? Is this a reality? Or are we just kind of getting an imperfect reality? Like, what is film?
Well, I think what you started out with is really important for us to remember, which is the maturity of a medium. And architecture as a medium has more maturity still than film. Information architecture has less than either.
Yep.
And just like there's genres in film, there is genre in architecture. Is there a genre in information architecture? There's so many aspects of this we could map. We're not going to. So we're going to try to, and I like, and we could end here. This is what we're going to be addressing film through. Primarily is the lens of this question, what makes it good? And we have a load of specific teachings about it.
I had like one more point. Like, sure, this would have been a really good question to end on. But I just want to point out, too, that this is super Western.
Yes.
The way that Wes Anderson makes his movies, it's very chaotic and very action-based. And what I wanted to show you guys was a still from the movie Ohio by Yasuhiro Ozu. I don't know, have you?
Yeah. It's so good.
It's so good.
It's so good. My dad's like randomly watching it, and I watched it with him.
Yeah, honestly, everything about this movie is pleasing. And the way that, first, Yasujiro Ozu, he came in the 40s, 50s, right before Akira Kurosawa, who was like one of the number one Eastern filmmakers ever. He did like all the samurai films. But what he did, he has a very minimalist approach, and he lets the structures that exist, like buildings, whatever, frame the scene and give the space meaning. So actually this is called ma in Japanese cinema, where he lets the negative space define what's important within the frame. And this is just an example. So this is an example of a Wes Anderson movie. So like, look how different the way this is structured. And this is just one example from Grand Budapest Hotel, but that's how Wes Anderson does his thing. And this is how Ozu does his thing. And I kind of wanted to show you, because it's easy to like talk about it and show you stills, but just watch this in motion. And this is also like, there's a lot of fart gags in this movie. but look at how like, this movie is also like showing exactly what's important.
そうだい。そうだい。そうだい。うん。ダメだよ。おい、どうしたんだい。おいでよ。どうしたんだ。来いよ。
This kid is also the cutest looking in the world. But see, like, this is a beautiful shot where he's letting this village tell the story, and they're just kind of these, like, people that are living in there. You know, this slice of life. He also
has a
really big vertical issue, but... Dan, I have a feeling you would really, really love this movie.
I can't wait to see it. And there is a... in The Timeless Way, he does mention a Kurosawa film, which is in the files section of the
So good. I know that I've, like, used up a lot of time, and we can skip this, but do you guys want to go over a Wes Anderson scene? Like, how I would interpret, like, 2 minutes just, like, riffing with you guys? Or... So, I didn't choose Rushmore because I haven't seen it that much, but I did pick a scene from the Darjeeling Limited. I think one of you guys have a group project with it. My bad. I'm going to steal 2 minutes out of it, but, like, this is going to just show you how much can be in, like, one little scene. So we'll watch it first. I think it's only 2 minutes long. But basically, all you have to know about this movie, and what's great about Wes Anderson, is that his characters and the plot can boil down to just, like, one kind of simple thing. And basically, you're three brothers in India that come to reconnect with each other because they haven't seen each other in a while. And things aren't going so hot. And they're on a train. That's all you need to know. Like, that's the context of this movie.
Is that Dan? Can I say something?
What?
You don't have permission to take his property that belongs to all of us and use it for yourself as if it's yours. Jack agrees with that, right, Jack? Plus, Dad would have hated it.
Why?
That's my opinion. I know him well.
That's a terrible thing to say.
Well, I don't mean it to be. I just don't want you to get the feeling that you're better friends with him than we are or something weird like that. And also, you can't leave your wife just because she's pregnant. Jack agrees with that too, right, Jack?
Stop including me. I'm his mayor. He told me that with blood all over him laying in the street right before he died. How is that supposed to make us feel? I want my passport back.
Francis.
Thank you.
You should go.
Basically, like, when I see this, and this movie actually means a lot to me. I watched it in high school, and, like, I have so many good memories of it, like, watching it with people. But first, like, what did you see throughout there? Like, what kind of stood out to you? Because I'll let you guys answer first before I give you my answer. Yeah.
It's really claustrophobic.
Yep.
But you still
pack
a lot of action into that small space.
Mm-hmm.
The way he's using the
mirror. Yep, Wes likes to use mirrors and he uses them very well.
It's always something that's in relation to people or they're doing something
completely different. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else?
I didn't have
to. Sorry.
Go ahead.
So I observed there's a lot of symmetry in each of the frames. Like, when the person is standing near the door and they're talking to the others, so it's like very symmetrical in the first
I was just going to say it's like very little representation of what they're talking about because they're having an argument and he's out of frame and then, like, he kind of pinches in every so often.
Mm-hmm. That's super important, and it matches like entirely with the dialogue. Anything else? I think that you guys made a lot of really good points, and especially because the space is so small, he's not using like a really good depth of field. Everything is super compressed. So this space here, we don't know how big it is, but we know how big this space is depending on like the motion that he's using, like with his camera. And I might just like turn this down a little bit. The way that they're combined together in frame really like separates these two. Like you think that they're ganging up on him, and that's, you know, kind of what happens. Also, look at the way that they're colored and dressed in comparison to the blues and oranges on screen. They're very drab because they don't really have a lot. Sorry, I love that line. They're here to reconnect as brothers, and that really hasn't happened yet. The color of India hasn't, like, and that sounds like a terrible phrase to say, too, and I regret saying it. But, like, all the colors here are not in with them yet. And the fact that Stop Including Me, like, he's out of frame, but he's also out of frame in the mirror. So that's a very important thing, too, that they did. Now he's gone within space. Now these two are more connected, especially between like the dynamics between the three brothers. This is all very important. He's also by himself in the mirror.
Yeah. No.
Yep, they're that action, they're divided, you know, they're obviously fighting and not coinciding together in the same space. He's gonna include himself now because he can, and they're related. Also, like, look how meticulous, like, this is packed and designed, so the colors are still pretty drab, especially in comparison to the plane, not the plane, the train. But the red also symbolizes, like, how angry this is, like, this action, even though he's doing it out of love. And how that little space suddenly like makes him so important, like.
Stop including me!
But he's still included, like within frame, which kind of gives indication to where it might go, and that's just funny. Oops. So, yeah. So that's a good way to kind of approach these things, is kind of square it off on its own. Look at it in the big picture, but also just like rewatch scenes over and over if it seems interesting to you, and you can find a lot of hidden pieces of information there. But yeah, that's all I had for you guys. So
thank you so much. That was super helpful.
I can also share this with you guys if
please,
you want connections.
I suspect that we will be referring back to it. Because many of us do not have these words, vocabulary.